Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national and international speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to put your iPod on or iPad or click listen or play on your computer. Today I'm joined by Sanjay Bhandari, a partner at Ernst & Young, and Trevor Horowitz, a director from Ernst & Young, along with attorney Quentin Archer from Hogan Lovells. They're all in the UK, and we're going to talk about something I know not a ton about professionally, which is UK data, privacy laws, and data protection issues, and we're going to throw some European answers in here as well. I will add, as an American exchange student at the University of Hull in England, I did have some problems with university housing authorities dealing with noise issues, and there were some privacy issues involved. I wish I'd had this team to consult with to defend me, as I found my American approach of going in to argue with the head of housing was not a successful strategy. But to segue back into the show, the point is there are differences between the U.S. and U.K. which go beyond tea versus coffee, royal family, solicitors versus lawyers, and the fact that accounting firms can hire and act like law firms. So with that in mind, let's introduce the panel. Sanjay Bhandari is a partner in the Forensic Technology and Dispute Services Group within the Fraud Investigation and Dispute Services Practice at Ernst & Young. He leads the UK e-discovery team, which is one of the largest practices in the UK with around 60 dedicated professionals. Sanjay writes extensively and has been published in e-discovery topics and publications such as The Lawyer, Legal Week, and Legal IT. He was the co-author of the Commercial Litigators Forum's two papers on electronic disclosure in 2003 and 2004. Many of the recommendations made in that paper are now reflected in the English Civil Procedure Rules and the U.S. Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. He's a frequent speaker at e-discovery conferences such as Legal Tech in New York, a Legal Week Strategic Litigation Forum in London, and at the Georgetown University Advanced e-Discovery Institute in Washington, D.C. Quentin Archer is a partner at Hogan Lovells and practices in the Data Protection and Information Management section. Quentin specializes in matters involving computers, communications, and other aspects of high technology. He regularly advises on the resolution of technical disputes, the preparation and negotiation of outsourcing and other IT agreements, and on regulatory issues such as data protection. And Trevor Horowitz is a director in the Forensic Technology and Discovery Services Group within the Fraud Investigation and Dispute Services Practice at Ernst & Young, and he has a particular experience in e-disclosure risk management, working in Europe, North America, and the Far East, and South Africa. So, Trevor, if you want to add some South Africa and Far East aspects to this, we could do a global show, okay? But just let us know when you're doing that.
Look forward to it.
Okay, so first of all, I always like to ask new guests about how you each got involved in electronic discovery. So why don't we go in the order I introduced you. So, Sanjay, if you want to kick it off.
Yeah, well, it was always my dream as a child to be an electronic discovery consultant. So I got into this, like everyone in this space, which is somewhat through the back door. So really, my background is I was a practicing litigation lawyer for about 15 years here in London. And the thing I hated most was doing discovery on massive cases. But so I ended up reluctantly becoming, an expert in issues to do with discovery and privilege. And it was really off the back of that that probably about 6 or 7 years ago, started being interested with a couple of colleagues at other law firms in how the English court treated electronic evidence. We were struck by the disparity in treatment in different cases with different parties having diametrically opposed approaches in exactly the same matter. And that was what spawned the Commercial Litigators Forum paper, which I was one of the co-authors of. And it was really off the back of that that I started my interest in e-discovery and then becoming an e-discovery consultant. So really from the rules drafting side, but a lawyer with a passion and an interest in technology. And over the last 5 years, really been building up my knowledge of the technology.
Great. I thought we were going to get a story about, you know, like nursery school and missing chocolate bars and e-discovery at the beginning. But anyway, Quentin, how about yourself?
Sure. Well, I've been doing litigation for the last pretty much 30 years as a lawyer in private practice. But my involvement with the electronic side of discovery has been clearly much more recent than that. In the last 10 years, my focus has been mainly on the data protection and privacy side. So that's involved me very much in the conflict between the demands of international civil discovery and data protection and other laws in various countries, which I think is fascinating and is unquestionably a fast-growing area.
And how about yourself, Trevor?
Thanks, Cole. My interest in e-discovery really stems from a background in technology, and specifically information technology. Probably blame my father for this, who rescued me from standing outside a computer store when I was about 11 years old, staring in at various computers in the store, including the Sinclair ZX1881. That kind of ages me straight in the conversation, I suppose. And really, I've had an interest in computers and an interest in data stored in them ever since then. I studied computer science and business information systems at university, and probably throughout my sort of misspent youth, I probably had a slightly off-color white hat interest in computer security. Having been involved in all of that, I really found myself once having to seek gainful employment working for a healthcare insurer in South Africa. And so I'll bring in some South African context to the conversation. But effectively, healthcare insurance in South Africa is big business. It is private, and you need to go for private healthcare. And obviously, because of that, there's a huge degree of fraud and abuse of systems. And so I was actively involved around about Y2K time in also helping the organization I was with develop anti-fraud procedures and fraud detection procedures, bringing me really into a computer forensic remit. Ernst & Young picked me up at about that period, and I really started very much focused in fraud investigation, specifically doing computer forensics. And I think, like a lot of people from a technology background, have grown with computer forensics as the data that we've had to analyze has grown. And so probably over the last 5-6 years, I see myself moving away from that sort of very deep dive computer forensics piece into doing electronic discovery and actually moving into more proactive areas around sort of understanding the strategic risks that corporates may face when dealing with large volumes of data on a daily basis.
Great. We'll have you when we want to do the expose on the U.S. healthcare insurance field. But anyway, so let's start with the topic. And Trevor, what do you see are the major differences between privacy and data protection in the U.S. versus the U.K.?
Well, I think the most well-known conflicts probably stem from the systematic differences in the approach and control of personal data protection rights. I don't think at the heart of it there is any fundamental difference between the U.K. and the U.S. on how we value information privacy. And I think we can all agree that certainly in the UK, and from my opinion and from my experience of having worked in the US, that we all agree that there is a right of an individual to information self-determination. And I think there's an agreement that there's a core set of fair information practices that are defined by principles of data quality, transparency or openness of processing, treatment of especially sensitive information, and enforcing compliance. So from a privacy perspective, I don't think there's much difference between our two jurisdictions. However, I think it's how it comes to be implemented and how we actually consider the protection of these information rights. And I mean, generally, there are probably two approaches to how we can protect these information rights. Certainly the UK-European approach, and the most predominant one that I work with, is a comprehensive data protection law. And this is really where legislation has created a comprehensive set of statutory rights and responsibilities for processing of personal data. Really, here we're treating data privacy as a political right based on fundamental human rights. Understandably, from a European context, experiences of individuals coming out of World War II, as an example, really focus on people having to protect their personal information and not really wishing to share that information inappropriately with government bodies or other activities. And I think that's the real focus in the UK and Europe, is that fundamental protection of a human right, which is our personal information. In the US, I think there's a slightly different approach, and you're probably looking at approach that limits the role of the state and legal rules of statutes, more defined to probably looking at sectors or industries,
And there's an assumption, I think, that information privacy will be self-regulating through industry agreements and codes of conduct such as HIPAA, rather than through government intervention. So in the US, data privacy, from our perspective, becomes more of a market-led issue rather than a political, and the focus is around the protection of consumers rather than data subjects.
Sanjay. I thought you were going to go with lawyers' rights in the U.S. We have rights to information. We have a lot of lawyers here.
You have too many lawyers there, Carl. I think one of the issues is it's an issue of perception. I think if you ask the average U.S. lawyer what they think of European privacy law, they think that maybe it's too onerous and there's too much of it. And you ask the average European what they think of U.S. privacy law, and they think you don't have it. And the reality is that it's just the difference in implementation that maybe results in that difference in perception, in that in Europe, it's implemented across sector, across industry. It doesn't matter. It hits the data irrespective of what sector you're in. In the US, actually, you have some similar privacy laws, but they're done sector by sector. And taking HIPAA in the pharmaceutical sector, you know, that's very similar to the privacy obligations we have over here. But the way in which it's implemented leads to very different perceptions, and I think that that has an impact on the way in which, in the relationship, I suppose, between the US and the UK and the rest of Europe, and the way in which we address these problems.
Okay. Quentin, we talked about how some of this show is going to go beyond the UK. So, into Europe. How do UK privacy and data protection rules compare with the rest of Europe?
Well, the whole of Europe, pretty much, every country of any size, has a data protection law, and the whole of the EU has adopted the Data Protection Directive of 1995, including, of course, the UK. So the principle is that the same data protection rules should apply in each country. In practice, they've been implemented in differing ways in each member state. And there is a particular difference, I think, between those countries which have civil law systems, which are the great majority of EU countries, and those countries like the UK, Ireland, and smaller places like Malta, for example, which have a common law system. And then you get down to difficult questions, perhaps, of the interpretation of laws. And we have had a fairly difficult time with interpretations of our Data Protection Act, which have been given by our Court of Appeal, which in a couple of cases, the Durant case and the Johnson case, have given fairly restrictive interpretations of some fundamental concepts in data protection, which have caused some conflict with our friends on the other side of the channel. The definition of personal data is one which has caused particular difficulty, at least as far as trying to reach agreement with our European friends is concerned, although not actually difficulty for the business market, because it's, if you like, quite business-friendly to have a restrictive interpretation of personal data, which is what our Court of Appeal has come to, rather than a much more expansive interpretation of personal data, which you will find elsewhere. And particularly in the e-discovery area, it's very necessary to know whether an email, for example, which may have no more personal data than the person who sent it and the person who received it, whether that constitutes personal data or not. If you look at the strict UK view, the answer is no. If you looked at the expansive European view, the answer is yes. And that creates a lot of problems when you're trying to create European-wide strategies for data protection and indeed e-discovery.
Huh. So it's more than just not the common currency. Anyway, interesting. Okay, so what are the repercussions, Quentin, for violating these rules, and who enforces the rules?
Well, enforcement of data protection laws is left to each member state, and so each member state has dealt with it in a very different fashion. And you've got very differing treatment from, if you like, the what used to be a very comparatively lax regime of the UK, and Ireland was probably fairly lax as well, where you used to have very little enforcement and more encouragement. And that's changing now with the introduction of monetary penalties, although they're still in their very early stages. To the top end of the scale, you have the, for example, the Spanish Data Protection Commissioner, which is essentially self-funding. The fines from Spanish data protection infringements will go back into the pot for the Data Protection Commissioner. So it naturally might be seen as an encouragement to issue notices of infringement in those circumstances. And there are several countries which can be, if they decide to pursue a particular infringement, quite hot and expensive, if you like, when looking at infringements, whereas others won't be. And it's difficult for business to work out really where they're likely to be hit. But I think one has to adopt a measure of common sense. There are really egregious infringements, for example, trafficking in people's personal data, when you can expect to have the full force of the data protection officials upon you, whereas if you've missed out a few words in a contract, it's unlikely that you will be given a strict fine, and you're more likely just to find it a little bit difficult to get your contract approved if you need approval from a regulator, or you may just be given a bit of a talking to, but that's as far as it's likely to get. But there is a patchwork, if you like, of enforcement provisions in Europe.
So, do you think that, I mean, one of the things we sense when we speak to businesses is that there's a kind of climate of maybe not quite fear, but certainly trepidation, that that there's a sense that certainly in the UK, maybe the commission, the information commissioner is looking to sharpen the teeth. And every business I speak to thinks that someone is going to be a high-profile victim, and they just want to make sure they're not the first. And my sense is that that's the climate we're in.
Yes, well, of course, being a lawyer advising in this area, I certainly want to encourage that climate of fear because it's going to be for business. But I think you're right in that the Information Commissioner certainly does want to sharpen his teeth. Not only does he want to, but he's being pushed to do so. There's been a lot of criticism of the Information Commissioner over the last year in particular because of perceived failures to act in some areas where people feel he might have been able to act. The Google Street View was a particular example where there was quite a lot of criticism in the press. One might see that as being unfair, I don't know, but nonetheless it's there, and he wants to use monetary penalty notices, which is a new power he's had since April, to penalise the worst breaches. In recent couple of years, he's mainly gone against government departments and against financial services institutions. Government departments, because their organisation has sometimes been a bit chaotic. Financial institutions, of course, because they process huge amounts of personal data. So they have many, many customers as members.
What was the ultimate disappointment or public outcry against the Google street mapping situation? I mean, what ended up, what was the anger over it that happened?
I think what was seen is that he made what appeared to be quite a quick judgment that there didn't seem to be anything particularly wrong about what Google was doing. Now, at that stage, he did not have the full facts. That was before it had been appreciated that some of the Google streetcars had picked up not just unintelligible snatches of IP addresses, but something a bit more substantial than that. Other regulators took a rather, in Europe, tended to take a rather more strict view, and in some cases have started criminal prosecutions. And it was felt by some that he'd rushed to judgment a bit too quickly. But I think that's, you could say, other people have the benefit of hindsight. He had to do something, and he did it promptly.
So, Trevor, what are the issues or hurdles people or organizations face during the processing and transfer of ESI across European borders?
From a practical perspective, it's really actually understanding what you can and can't do and understanding the practicalities of actually what you are entitled to do. So if we look at just the question itself, processing and transfer, that word processing has a very particular meaning when it comes to data protection. And processing is basically the handling of any data. So for instance, the mere placing of my information on a website is paramount to processing personal data. So really the question is, what are you allowed to do, and what do you need to do in order to have that allowance? So there are points around the consideration for what is fair and equitable processing of data. Do you have the right consent or permission to do that? And if you are seeking exemption, do you actually understand what the exemptions from consent are? What makes this interesting, and it leads back to Quentin's point, is that when you look at the interpretation and implementation of the principles in the directive, the European directive, exemptions are viewed differently across Europe. So what we in the UK or in England and Wales consider to be perfectly legitimate in continental Europe will be seen as a complete no-no. There's also a big difference, and one of the hurdles you need to consider is that consent to process or exemption, even for fair processing, is not the same as having the permission to transfer data. They are separate requirements, and again, even transfer of data across European boundaries can be complex, again, given just the interpretation and the assumed protection given to individuals in different countries across Europe. That, of course, becomes a real issue once that data moves outside of a jurisdiction that basically has implemented the directive, for instance, the USA, and then there are real concerns about what data can be transferred, what is allowing the data to be transferred? Do you have consent? Have you sought exemption? What exactly do you need to do? And those are the kind of questions that people don't appropriately either understand or don't know how to handle the practicalities.
I was just going to add two points to that, Trevor, which all of those points are absolutely spot on. There's two other things. One is to go back to kind of first principles, which is that For me, the root cause of the difficulties is the fundamental tension between the definitions of what constitutes personal data under relevant European legislation and the way in which data is required to be collected from the appropriate media for the purposes of a dispute, investigation, or other regulatory or legal proceeding. So the nature of a forensically appropriate collection inevitably involves the intermingling of personal data with non-personal data, so that at the point of collection, it is impossible to separate out the personal data, the sensitive personal data, the relevant data, the irrelevant data. And so you're automatically, in every case, have an issue around the processing of that personal data, because the mere act of collection in under the terms of the European directive constitutes processing. So that's the fundamental starting point that gives rise to all of the difficulties. The other thing that gives rise to, I think, to the difficulties and the nature of the difficulties between borders is that, to pick up on Quentin's point, in Europe, every jurisdiction within the European Union implements that directive. But so the directive, if you like, sets a minimum standard. But each jurisdiction within, each member state within the EU can have its own slightly more onerous obligations. And so we know that, for instance, France, Germany, Italy, Spain are much more onerous when it comes to compliance with data privacy than places like the UK. What you add to that is the way in which the lawyers interpret those exemptions. So there are schemes of exemptions within the directive which have to be implemented by each member state. And I would just highlight two exemptions because, in my experience, these are the critical two exemptions. For processing or transfer, there is always an exemption around legal proceedings. There is also broadly an exemption around consent, i.e. the consent of the custodian. And in my experience, very broadly speaking, in the common law jurisdictions, we're happier, the lawyers are happier to rely on the legal proceedings exemptions. And in the civil law countries, they are not. They prefer the consent exemption, which means you can even get the extreme and ridiculous scenario where you have a suspected fraudster, typically in somewhere like Italy, which is always a problem jurisdiction in my experience, and you're advised by the local lawyers, you can't even collect the suspected fraudster's data because that person has got a right to privacy over that data. Now, that same situation in the UK, we would probably rely on the legal proceedings exception. So, to me, those are the two really big issues, that the fundamental nature of the way in which you collect data and the inability to, at point of collection, to separate personal from non-personal, and the difference in interpretation in the exemptions.
Well, I was about to reference a big show in the U.S., The Sopranos, when you mentioned Italy. And but anyway, that's an interesting observation. Quentin, you know, we've talked about the EU Data Protection Act 95 and individual rules. Have there been any other recent developments in law, maybe case law, or that you'd like to point to in this area?
Sure. Well, in fact, just picking up on the point that Sanjay was making about the some of the big practical differences between member states' laws, the main development which is currently underway is a consultation in the European Commission on the next stage, if you like, of data protection law. There is going to be a new data protection directive or regulation. We don't yet know exactly what form it will take, but the idea is that some of the glitches in the current data protection regime will be harmonized, and some other concepts will be introduced. For example, the concept of accountability will be introduced in all probability, which means that businesses must not just comply with the law, they must show that they are complying with the law. They must show that they have policies in place to ensure compliance. But we hope that as part of that exercise, some of the least good differences between member states' laws will be eliminated. I referred earlier to differences in the concept of personal data. It might be asking quite a lot to see that eliminated across Europe, but nonetheless, we hope that it will. And similarly with the use in member states of the consent exemption. One big difficulty, for example, in Spain is that they do not have, as a condition of processing, that the data controller has a legitimate interest to process the data. They just didn't implement that, whereas most other countries have, which means that in Spain you really have to use the consent route if you're going to justify processing because there aren't many others. Now, it may be hoping a lot to think that all that's going to be swept away when we have this new piece of legislation. Nonetheless, this is the time for everybody to come together and try to create that. I think the consultation period for responses has just ended, but nonetheless, there's still a lot of work to be done. As far as the rest of developments is concerned, there haven't been any recent significant legislation across Europe in this field. And as far as case law is concerned, of course, that really only affects the common law jurisdictions, whereas in the rest of Europe, cases may be interesting but are not binding. I think there's been a lot of chat over the last couple of years about one particular French decision on their blocking statute, which is not specifically data protection law, but it does affect international discovery. France, like several other countries, has a law which is designed to prevent the kind of discovery fishing expedition that they suspect that the US practice is capable of. And in one case, for the first time, they actually fine someone for supplying documents in response to a U.S. discovery order without going through the proper channels. They and several other countries much prefer the use of the Hague Convention in those circumstances. We've also seen, of course, some cases in the U.S. Where, although the conflict between U.S. laws and discovery orders and data protection has been pointed out, nonetheless, the U.S. domestic court has ordered discovery, thus potentially placing the European party in a position where it might be in breach of European data protection laws. That has been the subject of a lot of consideration at European level. There has been an Article 29 working party opinion on this, or a consultation paper. That's the body set up under the directive to advise on the interpretation of it and also to look at possible changes to it. That has issued a paper on this difficult area of conflict between discovery orders and data protection. All of us here are involved with the Sedona Conference, which is another organization which has been looking at this area quite carefully and trying to bring experts from Europe and the US together to try to come up with some way in which we can transfer documents cross-border. But we're not yet at the stage of legislation there. We're at the stage of understanding each other, working out principles whereby we can do this under the current framework.
Yeah, we just did a show, our top 10 list of biggest cases of the year, according to Ron Hedges, who's involved also with the Sedona efforts. And he cited a case, I think it was a MasterCard case. It was one of the financial processing companies where the U.S. courts actually recognized data privacy laws were different in other jurisdictions, and I think said that they would abide by them. It's a very hot area. So this issue clearly affects multinationals. And Sanjay, what advice do you offer parties who are multinational with a presence in the UK and the United States who are involved in litigation that stretches into Europe or the UK? I guess get people like you on their team, right?
Yes, that's obviously the first bit of advice. I think it kind of depends on the business. We probably have two types of multinational.
How about find
business.
A French lawyer to be the fall person?
Well, that is one of the approaches. It's one of the answers, actually. I mean, I suppose in my experience, we have two types of multinational that we see. We have maybe the ones that are involved in sectors for whom disputes, investigations, and cross-border regulatory requests for information are an adjunct of doing business. So that tends to be financial services, pharmaceuticals and life sciences, oil and gas to a degree, technology and telecommunications. You know, for those businesses, this is an everyday part of the life of the general counsel and the litigation team. Now, for those businesses, they may already have a data privacy protocol. They probably have got a data privacy protocol. And the question for us is to, first of all, understand where physically the data is, not necessarily who the custodians are, but where is the data. And that is a particular issue in countries like in Europe because, the data centers may be in a completely different jurisdiction to the custodians. So mapping that data and then getting an understanding of any protocols that you already have, do they cover the litigation or disputes or this particular form of data processing? Because notwithstanding that many of those multinationals have data privacy protocols or policies, they're for the normal business as usual processing of data, and you're into a different scheme of exemptions when you get into a dispute or a regulatory request. So there's some verification of the internal processes they already have. It's really essentially what in which countries are the data, make sure you've got people in those countries, both lawyers and technology professionals who can actually get their hands dirty and collect the data and get it transferred when they need to, and the lawyers to make sure that we've got a strategy that's compliant with the law. And one of the things that we would do is articulate that in a written protocol so that if we're ever asked at some point in the future to justify the position we've taken, we've got it written down. Now, to some extent, that may be relying on a protocol they already have. To some extent, they may be drafting a separate protocol. Now, there's one type of business talked about, which is the business that's experienced in and for who in disputes and investigations, and for whom disputes is a natural adjunct to their business. And then there are plenty of other international businesses for whom disputes are a one-off occurrence. And for them, it is much more about leading them by the hand and helping them with articulating a process, because this may not be something that they have done before. The two other sort of non-technical things that we would say to clients, one is do it early. One of the perceptions I think we get from outside Europe is that European privacy represents a bar to the provision of data. It is not. It's a hurdle. but the closer and closer you get to that hurdle, the more and more it resembles an absolute bar. So do it early and you'll overcome the hurdle. Do it late and it will become an insurmountable object. The second thing is to understand the cultural difference. There's a good reason why we have data privacy laws in Europe. And it goes, Trevor alluded to it, and it's something I remember speaking at a conference in Georgetown a few years ago, and I know I spoke to Paul Grimm at a conference here a couple of months ago, and he said he's taken this back into the US as well, which is, if you think about the definitions of sensitive personal data in the EU privacy legislation, they're all around things like, ethnic origin, gender, sexuality, and so on. All reasons why people were persecuted during the war. So, of course, in mainland Europe, those things are issues that citizens take very, very seriously and take very, very personally. And so you have to appreciate that that is culturally an incredibly important thing. So anyone that's perceived as coming in and bullying and asking for data that might potentially impact on that kind of information, it is not going to get a very it's not going to get a rosy welcome. It has to be handled sensitively. Those are probably the thoughts that I have.
And Trevor, maybe you want to, if you have anything to add, because I was going to ask you what the most common mistakes made by U.S. parties concerning data privacy and protection are when litigating in Europe. And it seems like a lot of what Sanjay was talking about would fall on that list.
I think, a lot of it has been covered. I think from my experience, there are sometimes some really interesting perceptions that I've seen, sort of like, who does the Data Protection Act of England and Wales apply to? Surely it only applies to British citizens. That's a mistake, because actually it applies. If, for instance, Carl, I invited you over here for a beer and we went down to a lovely London pub and you decided to pull out your laptop and answer some emails, the fact that you're not a British citizen, or I assume you're not, makes no difference. That personal data in those emails, you may be answering various messages, is being processed in England and therefore does come under the remit of the English and Welsh Data Protection Act. That's an interesting one, because oftentimes I think there's a perception that it only applies to European citizens. And I think that's an interesting point. The blocking statutes or the perception of being blocked is always a mistake. I think there are legal vehicles you can make use of, and Quentin has already gone through some of those. And oftentimes just speaking to the relevant information commissioner in the particular country or area, they oftentimes make themselves available and are quite happy to work through dealing with issues. But fundamentally, from a practitioner's perspective, the biggest mistake I see is the over-reliance on safe harbor as being the excuse to take data out of Europe back to the US, especially if it's going to be processed or dealt with by a third party, i.e., for instance, a law firm who may be pursuing the litigation.
So, Quentin, what are the solutions? Think to one hand, maybe keeping separate data repositories in the country you're doing the litigation and processing there, or are there any other types of solutions you see?
I think there are different solutions for different problems, and it does depend on the type of litigation which you're involved in, the type of data you've got to transfer. So it's difficult to give a solution which will fix in every case. If you've got a standard piece of multinational litigation, you will find that if it's possible to make a request under the Hague Convention from the US for documents you want in Europe, that is likely to keep the data protection regulators happiest, because that's been officially blessed by the Article 29 Working Party I referred to before. However, the Hague Convention is quite unwieldy. It takes a long time to do. Not every country in Europe is a member of the Hague Convention, and it's generally unpopular and not used very often. I would echo what's been said already, that jolly good idea to have a word with the local data protection regulator, because some of the perceived problems might not really be problems in practice. If you bring up the helpline, for example, of the UK Information Commissioner, they may well say, well, if you've received a data protection request from a US court, we think you'd probably better answer it. So we think that the legal proceedings exemption here is probably made out. Not every other regulator in Europe would take that view, I'm sure. But it's an example of an approach you can make. Also, on a practical level, you do not need every single document that might exist to go to the US for discovery purposes, unless you really have no other choice because of some peremptory order which has been made. And it's very common, I think, for people to want to image laptops and then send them wholesale across to the US. Well, that's a little bit like staring in the face of the data protection regulators, because there you will be transferring not only relevant material but also wholly irrelevant material, some of which may be private, and you may be in danger of contravening various human rights and other laws in Europe, which is not a very good idea at all. And so I think it's taking a proportionate response to the situation, looking at what data really needs to be transferred. And then you have a range of options, because it may be that the safe harbor isn't open to you, but you may be able to use a model contract in certain circumstances. You may simply be able to use a controller processor model contract, and then have a very limited data set, which is ultimately the subject of discovery, and which you may be able to get permission from a local regulator. So there are solutions. They will not be something you can achieve overnight in every case. It may be something that you have to spend some time negotiating with the regulator in the most difficult cases. But we've had success when there has been a really difficult case. One example, which was published, was in the Madoff insolvency litigation, where we needed to cooperate with the U.S. trustee in the U.S. and basically transfer an enormous amount of information so that the investigations could be carried out appropriately, and the court order was made to that effect, so that there was an effective transfer sanctioned by the court, and it was done very quickly. It may well be possible in some cases to do that in other countries as well.
One thing that we've done, Carl, as well, and I've done this a number of occasions, and we've seen this has worked fairly effectively in a number of cases to manage the risk, really. This is about, you know, balancing the genuine need to have relevant data in the US against the genuine need to protect the privacy of data in Europe. One process we've adopted is really a staged approach to manage the risk in layers. So you might do the data collection, for instance, in somewhere that's very restrictive, like Germany. So in Germany, for instance, the data can't even leave the company's premises. So we do the collection on site, we do the initial data processing on site using a remote system inside the company's premises. If we're doing it over a number of days, that's under lock and key held by the general counsel so that we can retain the integrity over the data. What survives that might be transferred within the EU into a data hosting center. That might be elsewhere in Germany. It might be somewhere in the UK where there's many more of those kinds of facilities. First level review done inside the EU with the lawyers trained to recognise data privacy issues, and if they come across private data which is irrelevant, we can have a process to scrub that off the database on a regular basis. And then it's only that relevant, the data which is relevant, which then gets transferred across to the US. But you then have another belt and braces, which is train the US lawyers in understanding European privacy laws. And if there is something at that second and third pass review that is subject to data privacy, again, mark it on the database, and again, you can have a scrubbing. Now, we found that kind of process is, many clients have found that to be quite compelling because, well, it's quite a reasonable approach, and actually, what else could I do?
You know, there's been a moment every time I've done a podcast with someone from the UK. I did one with Chris Dale on e-disclosure, where I almost feel like I should have converted to being English when I was a student at Hull, because I've been trying to get people to do a process which I call think before process, instead of trying to look at everything right away, peel the onion back, use some of the newer tools to get your arms around a case. And don't follow the EDR model blindly. Start with a first step called thinking. And it really seems like you know, the answers you're giving in many part follow that process. Now, obviously, there's a lot more complexity with some of the data privacy issues that are there, which may almost force you like a speed bump to think a little more. I wanted to continue with that last thought about how you're putting cross-border teams together and ask Sanjay how you put the teams together, but add a question that is project management even more critical when you're dealing with all these complexities?
Yeah, I think when you know, that's kind of similar, the kind of scenario that I just outlined, you know, may involve three or four jurisdictions, and some kind of central project management is absolutely crucial, and choosing the seat for that central project management is crucial. I think what you need is generally it's putting together any effective team that it happens to be cross-border is coincidental, but it's no different to putting together any other successful team. There needs to be some leadership. There needs to be some central management and control. You need to, in a cross-border case, you need to decide where that central management and control is. It needs to, in my opinion, that needs to be relatively close to the data. Sometimes you might need a kind of passing over procedure, if you like. So, in a typical scenario where you've got data in Europe, but it's required for a dispute or regulatory request in the US, the initial period of providing the data collection, doing some of the initial processing and review probably needs to be managed here in Europe. And then once that is done, it's then passed over to another project manager in the US. And so there's some kind of a seesawing, if you like. In the early stage of the matter, it's the European privacy European project manager that takes the major role and just keeps the US project manager informed. And then there comes a tipping point when actually the US project manager takes control of the matter and the European project manager is only involved as and when needed if there's a follow-up question in relation to a certain item of data or if more data needs to be collected and processed. So that's a typical way of doing things for us. I think in terms of putting together cross-border teams, you know, there's a balancing exercise here between obviously having the right skills and the right people, but we are still in a relatively nascent industry, and that is a challenge in itself. There are lots and lots of skilled forensic technologists in the US. There are now quite a lot in the UK, and there are probably after that there's a few more in Germany. But then when you go out to the rest of the world, it's much more patchy because there is not quite that demand. And so for ourselves, what we tend to do is adopt a hub strategy. So you really get the most appropriate resources from the nearest hub, be that, you know, London or Frankfurt or Singapore or Hong Kong or Melbourne or wherever you happen to be in the world. You know, India. For ourselves, it's relatively easy for us to mobilise an international team because we have about, I think it's something like 600 people around the world that do this kind of work. So, you know, it's one of the reasons why clients come to us is because we have the ability to go and mobilise those people. But there are countries we go to where we don't have forensic technology professionals. You know, you go to Eastern Europe. Really, you know, you might go to certain parts of Eastern Europe or, you know, down to the Baltic states. You know, we do a lot, and we've done lots and lots of work in, you know, Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. Now, the important thing there is making sure you've still got someone local, even if they're not a technical expert. You need people who understand the local culture, the local language, who know how things are done in the Ukraine. And so you have someone with you, even if they're not a subject matter expert in what you do, they understand the local culture. That's absolutely crucial.
I was wondering if you've ever done a project where you got to ride in on a UN, you know, white vehicle, you know. But
if we did, we'd never talk about it.
I'm sorry, you know, I'm a little off my game at this point because it took me 3 months to finish a chapter on project management for a book on e-discovery, and I realized through much of your answer I haven't touched anything on international cases, and I'm fearful that I have to grab my chapter back and add some more. I literally sent it off this weekend saying I finally finished.
But, we can write that for you if you like, Carl.
You know what? I'm probably going to add something. I'll send it off to you. It'll only be a few areas, but I appreciate the offer. Quentin, I think we probably answered this about any tensions between the U.S. and Europe over enforcement of data preservation rules. That's my sense, but if there's anything you wanted to add, I wanted to give you the opportunity, or
I
go on.
You're quite right that we have had a lot of discussion about this. There is still certainly some tensions as far as understanding is concerned, in particular areas. I mean, Trevor referred earlier to the fact that there's been a sectoral approach in the US. There is still a different understanding, for example, about the area of employment. There is not an expectation of privacy in the workplace in the US. I think there's much more of a, dare I say it, a hire and fire culture, whereas there certainly is an expectation of privacy in many other European countries, even in the UK. And so the idea that companies don't own data, which is on company systems, because it may be personal data and subject to a data protection law, is something which is quite difficult for a US organization to understand. And we have to say, well, yes, you do in fact own, if you like, the electronic bits of it, but you don't have unfettered rights over it. Even if you've said so in your employment contract with the employee, you still don't have unfettered rights over it. There may be other rights, data protection rules, human rights rules, other constitutional rules in various countries. So that is a source of difficulty and, if you like, a possible tension. I don't think we're going to see that go anytime soon. But I do think that there is increasingly a much better understanding of the different systems. And particularly, I think we will see rapidly developing a comprehensive data privacy regime in the US. I wouldn't be surprised if in a decade's time we'll see something which is rather more comprehensive than we have in Europe.
Last question, Trevor, and given all the furor over the last 3 months or so, how does the WikiLeaks phenomena potentially impact any UK or European privacy rules to the extent targets of the leaks are based there in Europe?
I'm not speaking for any of the various commissioners around, but I think from a UK perspective, I'm certain that any approach we would take would be balanced and proportionate and quite pragmatic. But having said that, I mean, let's just go back to some of the fundamental discussions we've had today. You know, is any of that information of such a type that it can be used to identify a living individual, and has that information either been processed in Europe or European jurisdiction, or does it refer to someone who is European at some point in time? Is that information sensitive or not? I think dependent on how sensitive that information is and the impact of that, there could be a potential that there are data protection issues that come out of it. However, My initial feeling, and again, I'm not coming to this as a lawyer or any expert on the subject, is I think there are probably other areas of the law and other areas of investigation that will be far more important to driving any action taken on this. Quentin, from a legal perspective, can you see any major issue around that?
I don't think so. I think it's an interesting phenomenon, but we're coming up against, if you like, constitutional ideas in the US, which we don't necessarily have in the UK. I mean, many of these things, they've been banned to rights under our Official Secrets Act in this country if UK secrets are involved. But it is an interesting example of how there are different attitudes in different countries to what is essentially the same thing.
Yeah, I imagine the former head of Tunisia wishes he had some legal recourse. But well, I just want to thank all of you participating on the CSI Byte Show, Sanjay, Trevor, and Quentin. And I also wanted to thank Tyrone Edwards at Ernst & Young, who reached out and said, hey, this would be a neat topic. I always encourage people to reach out and throw out topics. It makes my job a lot easier. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I know I will listen to this show again. It filled in a lot of blanks in my knowledge, so I think it's been very useful. And I'm sure our listeners feel the same. Hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.